Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello and welcome. Charles Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, first published in 1859, is regarded as one of the most solid theories in science. But what if Darwin's theory is wrong? Now, some politicians and religious leaders denounce Darwin's theory, invoking a higher being such as God as the designer of our complex world of living things and us. But what if they're wrong too? Eric von Daniken is arguably the most widely read and most copied non-fiction author in the world. His first and best-known book, Chariots of the Gods, published in 1968, has been followed by over 40 more books, which have sold over 72 million copies and been translated into 32 languages. Eric von Daniken joins me now to discuss his latest book, Evolution is Wrong, a Radical Approach to the Origin and Transformation of Life, which offers a fascinating exploration on why the Darwinist theory no longer explains everything. Eric von Daniken, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you from my side. It's a pleasure to talk to you. You know, I'm sitting in Switzerland. It's cold outside. The high Alps are full with snow, but I'm happy to live in Switzerland.
I'll bet you are. I've spent a lot of time in Switzerland and I understand why you're happy to live there. Yeah. So for 65 years, your tireless research has inspired innumerable thinkers, researchers, authors, movies, TV series, while simultaneously infuriating scores of closed-minded scientists and academics who've dismissed your work as pseudo-history, pseudo-archaeology, and pseudo-science. What kept you going?
Well, it's my character. Of course, when you are young, you are not self-critical. You believe sometimes every rubbish. You believe every information. And only later, when you become older, you realize that that information was maybe wrong or that you were wrong in such and such place. So later, you accept the critics. But in the beginning, you don't accept the critics. It all started because I was critic in my own religion. I was educated as a Christian Catholic in a boarding school. And of course, I am a deep believer in God. I was at that time, as a boy, a deep believer in God. But God, to my knowledge at that time, had to be all over. We say in Latin, omnipotent, all over. God did not need a vehicle in which to move from one point to the next one. God is all over. Now, being in this boarding school, we had to translate parts of the Bible from Latin to Greek and Greek to German. And I realized that the God in the Bible is not omnipotent. He uses a vehicle in which to move around. So I simply had doubts in my own religion education. And that was the beginning of everything.
You must have very hard skin, though, Eric. You know, you've had such vicious criticism over the years. I mean, you know, you've really had to fight against that.
Of course. It's my character. It's the way I am. I said before, you are young and you make mistakes. Later, you learn that you made mistakes and then you correct the mistakes. So, but my character is to stand by. When somebody proves I was wrong and I had to accept I was wrong, then it's my character, do it better. Do it better next time. Don't repeat these mistakes. Do it better. So simply the way I am, I don't give up. I am a follower. I follow. And I was always sure, not only in my brain, but also in my heart, that I was sitting on the right track. The gods were astronauts.
So every book has been doing it again and doing it again and doing it again and doing it better every time.
Exactly. Every book.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are a few repetitions for the readers who did not know the earlier books, but there are always additions. There's always more information coming on. because the books were sold worldwide, I receive a lot of letters. Practically every day, we receive by internet 200 letters every day. So the people from somewhere far away write me, Mr. Van Deniken, why have you not mentioned the mystery near our village? I said, what mystery? What village? What do you live for? Can you send me photographs? Can you send me literature? What do your local archaeologists say about it? So, and slowly, slowly, more and more information comes together. And then I, of course, travel there. I do not write nothing which I have not seen and tested and smelled and talked to the scientists there. So it's my character. I am attacked. And I fully understand that the scientists who attack me, these scientists are not stupid personalities. They are all brilliant. They are, most of them are humorous, wonderful personality, but they are simply not interested in the subject. They said, you know, the Zeitgeist is the spirit of time. The Zeitgeist said, extraterrestrials, they don't exist. Maybe molecular form somewhere in meteorite, but we never had contact with extraterrestrials. So they say, we don't lose our time with this topic or with UFOs, but they are very intelligent person. And every intelligent person who starts to follow the track, who follow the information, comes to the same explanation. We are not alone. We have been visited by beings from outer space some thousands of years ago.
Yes. Yeah. And the zeitgeist is changing. Very much so. But let's talk about your latest book, Evolution is Wrong, A Radical Approach to the Origin and Transformation of Life. I have to say, this is one of the most eye-opening books I've read since Chariot of the Gods. And it contains countless examples of all kinds of characteristics that do not fit into the theory of evolution. So tell us a little bit about the arguments and the examples that you present in this book.
Well, there are so many. First of all,
I know.
generally, of course, we have evolution, generally spoken. I mean, everyone knows that all our different sorts of dogs, they have one mother original dog, sometime a kind of wolf, and they all descend from the wolf. So we know there is evolution in biology, but many things cannot be explained by evolution, because they do not fit together. It doesn't work the evolutionary way. So something with Darwin's theory is wrong. Partly right, but the big part is wrong. We cannot explain them. For example, there are frogs, a type of frogs. They live in Australia. And these frogs, after they have given birth to their little children, frogs, they take them all in their mouth. They grow up in the mouth of the frog. But the mouse is something which you eat, where you eat. You cannot, you know, growing up your own little puppies in your mouth. So it doesn't fit with evolution. Something is completely wrong here. Or we have plants, for example. Plants who eat meat. And some of these plants, if they are simply touched to another plant or to an insect, within a million second, they change something. They eat something, they have tentacles coming out, which in a million of a second, how would this slowly, slowly go on a way of evolution? It cannot have gone slowly. It must have been someone have given the order or someone has designed it. The question is, who was that someone? And that's the big fight in our society.
And that's exactly what we're doing now with things like CRISPR. You know, I mean, instant changes we're making in DNA, etc.
And that happened before. And that's not my idea. Look, if you read the old texts, old Sumerian texts, even in the Bible, you read that the gods created humans according their own image. Yes. What means according their own image? And then the so-called, in the Bible, the so-called fallen angels had sexual contacts with human. If really somebody... angel had sexual contact, a real angel, a spiritual being, would never have sex. If really angels were taken literally as being with the blood and flesh, so their sexual apparatus must have been the same. Otherwise, they cannot come together with females, with the planet. Not only this, the number of chromosomes had to be the same. Otherwise, they could never make children. So these extraterrestrials, these so-called fallen angels, were in reality extraterrestrials who visited us and who changed the genetic form of the genome. We can prove this in the meantime. Again, we have evolution until a certain stage, and then extraterrestrials come. I can explain later why they have come. It's not by coincidence. Extraterrestrials come, they realized on this planet Earth we have thousands and thousands of forms of animals. One of the animal form was the most advanced one of our forefathers. Now they take simply a cell or two or three cells of one of our forefathers. They change the DNA in the cell, which, by the way, every student of biophysics and biology does today. No, we do in genetic does today. They change the DNA, you know, the base, the DNA. They put it in the liquid, the cell, to a little liquid of nutrition. The cell grows, is planted in the womb of the female of the same species. The female will give birth to a child. The child has, of course, all the influence from evolution. I mean, the body, the chest, the head, the eyes, it all comes from evolution. But the child has something in plus, which the rest of the family tree has not. The child has curiosity, intelligence. Look, on our planet, our forefathers, orangutans, chimpanzees, apes of all types, they still do exist. They are still in the forest, but none of them has become intelligent. Only we. Why? And we come out from the same family tree. They all should have become intelligent too, should have developed culture, but they have not. Why we? Because we were taken out of the family tree. Somebody changed our DNA according their own image. They wanted to create an intelligent species on this planet. And I think the goal is that we develop technology, technology, technology. Finally, we will construct spaceships again, and we will go out again like a snowball system. We will send and spread out intelligence and curiosity out there in the universe.
And we'll be doing it to others?
We will go in where?
And we'll be doing the same thing to other species.
We will be doing the same thing to others. We will define other planet with primitive beings. We will do the same thing. We will help them. We will put our DNA in them. You know, at some time, at some place, the universe started. We have no idea why it started and how and when. That's a place where we respectfully with religion say, this is what we call God, the beginning. So, but then slower. Whenever an intelligent form has created, and it must have created an intelligent, because we are the proof of it, we are intelligent. In every form of intelligence, you have something in your brain you cannot change. This is called curiosity. Curiosity will bring each form of intelligence into space. Why? Imagine our scientists on our planet would know everything about the planet. We have made a hole through the planet. We found out every brain of every animal, the little and the big one. We know everything about human. Simply, we would know everything. What is next? We would look up there at night. We would see the little lights up there. And because we have curiosity, we are forced to ask, what is this? We will go out. Every form of intelligent life will sooner or later make space travel. They will find out, are we alone? If others exist, how do they look like? How have they solved their problem, etc.? The curiosity will force us to go out there. And that happened the same thing for the others. They were here because of curiosity. And it was not by coincidence. If we would be able to make space travel in big distances, where would we go, we humans? We certainly would sit together and ask, start with our own solar system. Should we go to Venus, to Mercury? Never. It's too hot. We simply die because of the temperature. We could go to Mars, but we have to build our own atmospheric conditions there. We could go to some of the Mars moons, which is true. Later out, the next planet, Jupiter, we would never go. It is gigantic, Jupiter. The gravity would simply press us to kill us. And the atmospheric conditions are methanium, ammoniac. So we go not there. And far away out there, Jupiter, Pluto, Uranus, Neptune, they are too cold. they are too frozen. That means we humans, we look from the beginning for a landing place which is suitable to us. We want to work on the landing place. Now, this is the first filter. The same happens for the others. They have asked them, where can we land? Where can we survive? Where can we work? This does not exclude that maybe we have intelligent forms of life which we cannot even imagine. Form of spirit, in spiritual forms, beings with 20 tentacles and 15 eyes. Everything is possible. But the ones who visited us were similar because they looked for the similar landing place, the same as we would do in the future. It all has a certain logic in it. The final goal is spread out, make the universe intelligent, collect information as many as possible, and bring them back home. Home means the great spirit of the universe.
Tell me, there's some really fascinating stories in the book about different species of, you know, animals, insects, just about everything you could think of. The one that I think probably is capturing most people's imagination is the blob. Say a little bit about the blob. I mean, what is it?
Nobody knows what the blob is. The blob is just a something you can see, you can touch. It's a little something. And the original blob is in a museum in Paris. I think it's in the Anthropological Museum in Paris. Now, the blob has been separated and cut in different pieces. Several scientific groups in different countries of the world are studying the blob. We don't know what the blob is because, according to us, intelligence means brain, means neurons. The brain has to communicate with another. The neurons have to communicate. This blob has no brain. There are no neurons, but this blob is intelligent because if you cut it, it goes to a certain direction. If we know the blob doesn't like salt, so it would not cross a line of salt, but the blob learns to go around the line of blob. Scientists have constructed a labyrinth and put the blob into the labyrinth, and the blob found out the way to the labyrinth. So the blob is intelligent, which is completely against evolution because the blob has no brain, but he is intelligent. So what is this thing? I said many institutes worldwide are making researches on the blob. We have no final answer. I think these things come maybe from outer space.
Ah, well, yes. Where could it have originated from? It had to originate somewhere. The thought that there is something that exists that has intelligence that nobody can categorize is just mind-blowing.
The what?
Mind-blowing.
Mind-blowing, yeah, different. There are many things which are mind-blowing, which we can really not explain in evolution.
Mm. But, you know, more and more scientists are now, talking about we need to reinvestigate Darwin's theory. I mean, there was a petition, wasn't there, that was critical of Darwin's teachings. And so many scientists, National Academy of Sciences, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, MIT, they all stated that the previous evidence for Darwin's theory should be carefully examined. I wonder how many of those scientists were once defenders of Darwin's theory.
Well, I mean, it's really time that the zeitgeist, the spirit of time, changes. Until a few years, evolution was an absolute credo. You have to believe in a scientific community. If just 10 years ago you would attack the theory of evolution, they look at you as a stupid. You're not taken for serious anymore. You are out of the scientific community. Now, because of our knowledge, especially the knowledge in genetics, we learn that many things cannot be explained with evolution. We have to look for new possibilities. And one of these possibilities is what we call somebody has done it. What for? Who is this somebody? What was the reason? What are we? There are theories which exist worldwide, for example, that we are just our planet and the humans and the animals. We are just a kind of zoological garden. Somebody is observing us. Somebody is observing all the other animals. Now, in a zoological garden, you always have two parts. You have the guardians they have to take care that everything works clearly in the garden, that no wrong animal eats the other animal, etc. And you have the visitors, and you have to be careful that the visitors also, they behave themselves correctly, that they do not kill or destroy some of the animals. Now we are in a zoological garden. The watchers are watching us. They realize there are billions of life forms on this planet, and one life form develops more at once. They develop culture. They develop singing. They make arts, artifacts, etc. So they realize this form is more advanced than the others. Now they know sooner or later, because of curiosity, they will try to escape from their prison. Should we let them escape or not? And I think the idea is we have to observe them soon as they realize they are not alone. There are other intelligent beings out there. Soon as they realize we are not the greatest, then they are ready for a contact with outside. Before, we cannot let them go out. You know, on this planet Earth, we have generally spoken, we have two types of humans. One type is scientific, the other type is religious. The religious type was told God made everything, but as crown of creation, he made us. The scientific type said everything is evolution, but we are at the top of evolution. Have you ever remarked that in both cases, religion, crown of evolution, science, top of crown of creation, top of evolution, in both cases, we look at ourselves as the greatest? We have a psychological problem. We don't want our extraterrestrials. We have to learn we are not alone. We have to learn we all, it doesn't matter of black or white or red or yellow or whatever, we all are the intelligent species on this planet. We are one humanity, and it is our goal to go out, to make contact with the other. But those who observe us, they only let us out if we realize that you are not alone, there are others.
Have you ever had any contact?
Yes, no. I never saw a UFO. I never had a direct contact. But I have from time to time wonderful dreams. And these dreams, they seem to me as if they would be realistic. So I am in the dreams somewhere else, and I speak to extraterrestrials. I remember just a few years ago when in a dream, my daughter came into my room and said, Eric, you must go outside. There are extraterrestrials. And I said, this is ridiculous. There are no extraterrestrials. And she said, Eric, please come outside. There are many humans who assemble them. Someone to attack them. Come out there. And don't forget, it's all a dream I'm talking about. So I went out, and there were extraterrestrials with big, long heads. And the funny thing, I could speak them from the beginning. I knew their language. So only in the dream, obviously, I have contact. In reality, I never saw a UFO.
In those dreams, do you get information that takes you on a different path, perhaps, or gives you some extra insight you didn't have before?
Definitely. Absolutely clear. I really can prove this. In my first book, Chariots of the Gods, I mentioned a Dead Sea Scrolls. It's called the Lamech Scroll. Mm. In that Lamech Scroll, Lamech is a shepherd, and he was away for quite some time. And when he comes back to his home tent, his wife, her name was Batenor, she had just given birth to a child. And Lamech, the father, says to his wife, to Batenor, this can't be my child because I was too long away, more than 9 months. So it is impossible. But Batenor swears and swears that the seed, the insemination comes from him. She had no contact, sexual contact with no one. She even precises no soldier, no guardians, nobody had contact. But there is the child. So Lamech doesn't know where to go. He goes to his father. His father was Methuselah. And Methuselah asks him, what should I do? There is this child, but it can't be my child. Methuselah again goes to his own father, which was Enoch, the same Enoch of the Bible, who wrote the book of Enoch. He was in contact with extraterrestrials. And Enoch says to Methuselah, go to your son Lamech. Tell him the guardians of the sky have inseminated Batenosh without a sexual contact. Now, you ask me if I have information from outside. I have written this story in my book, Chariots of the Gods. But only 1.5 year later, I learned from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and exactly the same story was in the Dead Sea Scrolls. I asked myself, where did you get this from? So somebody obviously used or misused my brain.
Well, the German title of Chariots of the Gods translates as Memories of the Future. Now, that's a very interesting concept. What do you make of that?
You see, nobody can have memories of the future. In the German, it says Erinnerungen an die Zukunft, Memories of the Future. When I came out with my first book, I was looking for a publisher. And finally, I found one. He said, Eric, this title is impossible. You cannot remember something of the future. I said, yes. I see it like a gigantic circle. Something happened, and it will happen again. It will return. It will come. The back will come to the future. Like history, it repeats itself. That was finally the title, Memories of the Future.
Yes, and I know many people who have had all kinds of near-death experiences who have memories of the future.
And, you know, since we know more about genetics, as we said in the beginning, something in evolution is wrong. We can prove it on genetics that something is wrong. And we also have this story with these elongated heads. These elongated heads you find worldwide, not just in Egypt or just in Sumeria. You find them worldwide. Now we know from South America, for example, that the parents, they took their children, their babies, and pressed the brain together. The bones were soft, so the brain becomes longer and longer. But why have they done this torture to their own children? Because the child should look like one of the gods. And this is not speculation. When you see old Egyptian statues of the gods, Osiris, Isis, they have this long head. There are statues where Osiris and Isis have their just little babies on their arms. And they all, the babies from the beginning, have already their long heads, that's elongated head. So it looks to me as if the extraterrestrials who were here, they had this long head. And we simply try to copy it because we want to be like them, or at least to look like them.
What is the response that you're getting from the scientists and the academics to this particular book?
In the beginning, I was just crashed down. Everybody said, this is nonsense, this is garbage, this is whatever, and so. Now, in the meantime, I have become an old man. I mean, 2 months, I am 88 years old. I'm happy the gods protect me. My brain functions perfectly. And slowly, I get more and more recognitions from the academic community. I know this because I am invited in some circles, on which I will not talk about in public, some academic circles and some circles like the Freemasons, etc., which never happened 10 years before. They are interested to get in contact with me. And slowly they say, maybe he's right. Maybe there were extraterrestrials here. We should be careful and not damn him down.
How do you feel about that, with people beginning finally, you know, to give credence to your work?
I have a lot of personal contacts. I said in the beginning, we receive over 200 letters every day. Mm. I have a lot of personal contacts here in Switzerland. Some old scientists, which are retired in the meantime, we talk together for hours. And some of them admit we were wrong, especially the ones who made biblical translations. In the meantime, we see that these biblical translations in the past were made from a religious point of view, from a psychological point of view. In the meantime, we see when we have in the Bible a phrase like glory of God, the glory of God. It was not the glory. It was something real, something existing. When we read in the Bible that the God descended with smoke and fire and loud noise and trembling, it was not spiritual. It was not an apparition like in the prophet Ezekiel. It was real. So especially the biblical scholars with new translation, they are very, very good support. I just yesterday had one here, Mr. Mauro Bellinio. He's a biblical scholar here. He worked for 34 years at the Vatican Library. He knows old Sumerian languages and old Hebrew. And so, and we were talking together. I said, Eric, our translations were wrong. The zeitgeist, the spirit of time has changed. Today we see it with new and fresh eyes. It's time we retranslate these old texts. And I think and I hope within the next 2 years, slowly, the spirit of time will change.
Well, what happens to religion then?
Religion will continue. I mean, we will lose the belief in, for example, religious figures like Jesus Christ or the great prophet, but we will never lose God. In the beginning, the universe was created and we have no idea, neither science nor religion. We have no idea what started this universe. Religion says it was God. Okay, but what created God? Where did God come from? Science says it was a Big Bang, another theory. What started the Big Bang? It doesn't matter. Even those scientists who say the universe is like a circle. It has no beginning. It has no end. It existed only. It's not the answer. Every circle, and even if a circle for eternity, had to have a starting point at someone. So we have no idea how this universe started, who did it, why, etc. And there, in every respect, with every religion, we say God. So you will never lose the believing in God. You may lose the believing in your religion, which is not so important, but you always keep in deep respect the believing in God. By the way, I'm an old man, but I pray every day to what I call the grand spirit of the universe.
Do you think that we're going to see disclosure anytime soon?
Yes, the situation changes. I mean, we know that some part of the U.S. Navy has given now some of these files free of UFOs, and others, Chile, the state of Chile in South America, has done this, and in Turkey too. So slowly, slowly, we will learn that something is wrong up there. And it's not enough just to say we have a physical phenomenon which we at the moment have no scientific explanation, but maybe in 10 years we can explain it. It's not enough, because these beings, Entführungen. Anyhow, they capture some of the humans, and in some others they made implantates. So we have implantates, we have the object which extraterrestrials put in. So it's not enough to say something exists out there. No, there's something had a brain, was intelligent, want to know something from us. And we are their offsprings.
Yes, yes, we are. What is your next book, Eric?
I'm always, by the way, the book Evolution is Wrong, which you mentioned, which is the term. In Germany, the title is different. In Germany, it says, alles Evolution oder was? Everything evolution or what? Question mark. In English, they translated, evolution is wrong. The German version has a question mark in.
Question mark.
It doesn't matter. You ask for my next book, I always receive more information, especially what I said before concerning old translations of the Bible and other Sumerian texts. It will be all about this. But so God will, I need my brain for the next 2 years.
Wow. Yes, I know that you, you're good friends with Paul Wallace, and Paul is going to join us after the break give his take on this particular book, Evolution is Wrong. But I just want to say thank you. Thank you for publishing Chariot of the Gods. Thank you for opening so many people's minds. And thank you for joining us today.
And give my regard to Paul Wallace. He's a brilliant researcher.
Isn't
and a brilliant
he?
Man, a wonderful personality.
Indeed. Eric von Däniken, thank you. We know Eric's time is limited, but the show will go on. And Paul Wallace is going to join us after this break, so stay tuned.
Om Times TV. Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust spheric approach. Om Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, Om Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an Om Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on OM Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive OM Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. OM Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times' flagship radio show, What Is Going On? And as an author, editor, and 13 times book judge who's read thousands of books and interviewed hundreds of authors, I'm constantly asked what's really worth reading and what's not. So I created the No BS Spiritual Book Club to help you save time and money by picking the brains of discerning names who've walked this path before you. There's no catch, no fees, and no BS. Just an ever-growing library of 10 best spiritual book lists from some of your favourite authors and teachers, plus free book excerpts, audios and video interviews with people like Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., David G., Lee Harris, Mark Nepo and more. From well-known classics to hidden gems you've never heard of, it's the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to enlighten your journey of self-discovery. So why not join the club? Get inspired and save money at the NoBSSpiritualBookClub.com.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's one in five daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. With me now to expand on Eric von Daniken's research on evolution and the evidence of paleo contact is former church minister and researcher Paul Anthony Wallace, whose interviews, documentaries, and books on spirituality, mysticism, and the mysteries of human origins are watched and read by millions of people worldwide. Paul, thanks for joining us.
G'day, Sandy. Thank you so much for having me on today.
So now, I know that your first introduction to Eric occurred when you were 11, and now you're not only friends, but he's also endorsed your Eden Trilogy series of books. What impressed you so much about Chariots of the God back then?
Well, it was great timing for me discovering that book because I was already an enthusiastic skeptic as I listened to the explanations of Christianity on the one hand and science on the other for explaining our presence on planet Earth. We are an anomalous species on this planet. We're somewhat ill-adapted to it. The only way we thrive on it is because of our higher consciousness and intelligence. And even as a young kid, from the age of 5 to 6 years old, I was aware of this and felt there was this gap in our ability to explain ourselves. So when I discovered Chariots of the Gods nestling among the magazines on my mum and dad's coffee table, I read that and felt that Eric had put his finger on that. He had sort of spoken a taboo. And I felt that the leitmotif of that work was absolutely correct. This is bringing all my intellectual abilities as an 11-year-old to it. But I felt, well, he's saying something I'm not hearing anybody else say, that we can make better sense of our story as a species if we allow for the possibility of an intelligent external intervention. And it was that that I really grasped onto. There was tons of other detail in there that was absolutely fascinating, intriguing evidences of earlier cultures and civilizations, but it really was the story of our evolution as a species that gripped me, which is why I'm so interested in his latest book, Evolution is Wrong.
Now, you told me that you can affirm what he says in that book about our planetary conditions attracting similar forms.
Well, that's exactly right. My start point was thinking that we, as Homo sapiens, are an anomaly on planet Earth. But in fact, life on Earth is a strange anomaly too, because once we got into the 1960s and we had the work of Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the double helix structure of DNA, he looked at the complexity of that and said that the time frame for planet Earth is not long enough for the genetic code for life on Earth as we know it to have formed by a random process. The timeline of the planet forces the origins of life on Earth off planet. And so he was an enthusiast for the theory we call panspermia. And panspermia is the idea that the genetic code for biological conscious life is as much a part of the property of our cosmos as the properties of light or gravity. And that whenever this coding lands in an hospitable environment, it will generate forms of life similar to the ones that we're familiar with here. And when I was researching for my first book in Paleo Contact, Escaping from Eden, I was blown away by how many credible scientists, especially in DNA research, who were willing to put their hand up and say, yes, I believe in panspermia too. And I discovered that by the time I wrote Escaping from Eden, the European Space Agency had spent $80 billion testing the theory of panspermia, looking for the building blocks of life on comets traveling through our solar system. So you invest that much money, you're taking it pretty seriously. And as I got back into the works of Plato, I realized that theory is really just putting nuts and bolts on something that Plato had suggested 2,500 years ago.
So tell me more about what Plato had suggested.
Well, Plato is an incredible person. Everyone should read Plato. He is one of the most important minds in human history as we know it. There was a British philosopher who once described the whole of the Western tradition of philosophy as no more than a series of footnotes to Plato. That's how important he is, and nobody disagreed. And Plato comes to these amazing, far-reaching conclusions in three ways. He does what we would call science, which is applying logic to things we can all observe. And then he also pulls together ancestral information, which he does from ancient Egypt in particular. And then he draws other information from what we might call altered states of consciousness. And he has an experiential argument there as well. He, on the basis of his science approach, reaches the conclusion that prior to the material cosmos emerging was a unified field of consciousness. So he argued that consciousness preceded the material cosmos. And then he goes further and he says the material cosmos exists, it came into being in order for that consciousness to experience itself. Now, this sounds like a really woo-woo abstract thing to say, except that panspermia is simply an engineer's version of saying the same thing, that the cosmos hosts the genetic coding for biological conscious life. This is how consciousness experiences itself and expresses itself. It has a place to land. It has environments and niches in which to land and develop into life forms. And so when Francis Crick put forward this idea, he really was beginning to put detail on something that Plato had said 2,500 years ago. And there's more science to support that view now than when Francis Crick put it forward in 1968. So you come to the present day, and some of the leading figures in the study of genetic coding are Vladimir Scherbak and Maxim Makukov of the Kazakh Al-Farabi National University and the Fizankov Astrophysical Institute. And on their studies, they concluded, and this was way back 10 years ago now, they published their findings, that there are patterns in the structure of the genetic code that point not only to great antiquity, but to intelligence and to design. Now, of course, all those who are into intelligent design or Christian creationists jumped upon this and said, oh, look, they're proving our theory. But those two scientists were very careful to take a step back and say, no, we're not. always saying is it wasn't random. There's elements of intelligence and design that pushes the story of life in our cosmos further back to a previous source, but it doesn't get us back to a zero point. What it tells us is that the genetic coding has patterns embedded within it that have a 1 in 10 trillion chance of being random. And so this is, in effect, the Paley's Watch argument on steroids, but they've got the science to back it up and say, no, this is not random. The fact that there is coherent life emerging on our planet and very probably all through our quadrant of the cosmos is by design.
Absolutely. And you agree with Eric that seeing ourselves in a populated universe as a mid-ranking species does give us a psychological problem. What is that problem?
Well, it was a psychological problem for me personally, because for many years I traveled through the world with an essentially orthodox Christian worldview, in which we can explain ourselves to a degree by saying that we are God's special creation. And that sense of a special connection with God, the source of the cosmos, was part of where I got my sense of confidence to go through life with and to take risks and to be adventurous, because I believed we had God's attention, we were his special children. So to go from that to a universe in which we are just one species among, who knows, maybe millions of similar species, some of whom may be more advanced than we are, is a bit of an adjustment. But as I drill down into the world's ancestral narratives, I realized that our elders' explanations of human origins have us not only as a mid-ranking species, but as a species that's been altered and genetically modified and tweaked by other species. So suddenly this sounds more like the story of Dolly the sheep or the production of the German Shepherd dog. And suddenly that's a very lowering way in which to see ourselves. And my initial reaction was, why on earth would God allow that? And I realized once I'd answered that question that I hadn't really come to terms with the idea of a populated cosmos. He'd allowed Dolly the sheep, he'd allowed the German Shepherd dog. Why on earth wouldn't he allow us to be modified? And I had to go back to my earlier questions as a 5 or 6 year old to say, no, this is about explaining where we came from. And then I have to come to terms with the implications. But it was a big adjustment. And I must say, in my coaching from week to week, I find a lot of people struggling with this question. How do I get my sense of significance and safety in the world if that really is our story?
Well, you know, the other part that people have to shift their perceptions about is, you know, these advanced beings that may have been, you know, manipulating our DNA, etc., are also God's children, God, the sparks of God, that everybody thinks that they are, or we as a, you know, population on Earth, we think we're the only ones that are the sparks of God, but they are too.
That's exactly right. And I remember in 2009, when the Roman Catholic Church was addressing this topic, the implications of contact with other species, they said we should be ready to embrace any neighbors we encounter as brother or sister aliens. That was the language they used. And I think you're right. We have to see all life in the cosmos as emanations of the source. It is one big cosmic family, not to make it all sound, you know, super light and sweet, because there's conflict that's in the story. There's suffering and trauma in the timeline of Homo sapiens. But ultimately, we are all related, and all life is an expression of that genetic coding, an expression of the source.
Yeah. So you read Eric's latest book, and you've seen the first segment of this show. What do you think? What do you think of where he's heading?
Yeah, I love that he's written this book. I really enjoyed it. Because it appealed to me personally, and the sort of origins of my own quest for information and understanding, I remember way back, I am old enough to remember when David Attenborough announced his new series, Life on Earth. And I was very excited to see the trailer for this series because, and I should preface this by saying, I think David Attenborough is a saint. I absolutely love his work. I think he's an incredibly important person. The sense of awe and wonder that he's brought to us as a species on planet Earth is a wonderful, precious gift. Mm-hmm. But Life on Earth disappointed me in one respect, because the trailer said he was going to explain how we have very complex systems of multiple species who all depend on one another in order to exist. And he was going to explain how the system formed, which creature came first, the predator, the prey, the parasite, the virus, and explain how these systems form that would seem absolutely counterintuitive. And that was the one thing his series did not explain, and really left me with all those questions. And so what I like about Eric's new book, Evolution is Wrong, is that he simply states that question chapter after chapter after chapter, showing us the complexity of these interspecies systems, and then even systems within animals themselves. And he shows that the mechanism of Darwinian evolution is inadequate to explain life on Earth. And if I can make a provocative statement, there is no other model for evolution. We have not replaced Darwin's explanation of a mechanism by which evolution would work. He argued that you get modifications happening, and he said it was random, that become reinforced by the law of the survival of the fittest. So you get a modification that gives you a survival advantage, you're going to produce more young. So over generations, over millions of years, that is the expression of the species that will dominate. Well, that's great for microevolution, but to explain the fossil record goes nowhere near far enough, because what we see in the fossil record is leaps from one species to another, where whole systems have appeared in the new creature that could not have appeared in stages. So he gives various examples. One of my favorites is the bombardier beetle, which has a built-in flamethrower. That gives it its survival advantage. But you cannot get to the flamethrower without three elements coming together. The whole system has to form to create the survival advantage. So how do you get there? There's no mechanism for it. This is something that fascinated me. And I remember back in the 80s, evolutionary scientists started using the language of teleological evolution to explain these huge leaps and why we would see, in effect, new species emerging who are intact, operational, lock, stock and barrel, with no intermediary stages. I went along to talk to some scientists from the Natural History Museum of London in the UK to discuss the whale, which I think is the most fascinating example of this problem. And so I got into conversation and I said, the current consensus is that it was an ungulate, something like a cow, or as Eric von Daniken argues in his book, a hippo, that became modified into the whale, that it was a land-dwelling mammal before it was a whale, that it had four limbs before it was a whale. And so I asked, how do you get from something like a cow to a whale in gradual stages that all give a survival advantage? How does the cow sprout a functional fish-shaped tail, for instance? Because surely that has to happen all in one go for it to give an advantage. Well, to my amazement, the experts from the Natural History Museum turned around and said, no, it's far more complicated than that. Because not only do you need that tail, the skin needs to be different. The respiratory system needs to be different. The eye needs to be different. that nostril needs to move. All these things have to happen in one hit. And I said, well, how does that work? And they said, well, because there are genetic codes for a fish-shaped tail. There are genetic codes that put the blowhole here. Genetic codes for this kind of respiratory system, so on and so forth. And those codes belong together. Well, I went home and puzzled over this and realized that what my scientific friends had done was simply to restate the question. These codes belong together. Well, yes, I know. That's really what I was saying. This whole animal has to emerge intact in one fell swoop. But what makes the codes belong together? And then if it's a code, how is that code constructed? There is a coherence to it. And the language of teleological evolution was that evolution knows where it is going and therefore groups these codes together. Well, if there's a knowing, something has to know.
Yeah.
So what is the thing that knows, or who is the thing that knows? Teleological evolution just seemed to be another way of talking about a designer without conceding that you're putting intelligence and design back into the picture. Now, Eric's book makes that point time after time after time, species to species. And I just, there's something, it's like a juggernaut. It just doesn't stop from chapter to chapter. And I think it's very hard to read that book and not come away saying, yeah, there are heaps of questions that have not been answered. Yes, the model is fundamentally flawed and nothing has been put in its place to explain it to us. With all the advancement in our understanding of DNA and genetic coding, we really are still at the beginning of working out not only where humans came from, but where all life on Earth came from and how it turned out in this incredibly precise and coherent and functional way.
You know, you and I have been talking for what, nigh on 2 years now, possibly. Have you noticed, and in that time you brought out several books, and there's so much information, you know, that we've got through quantum science, the physicists are sharing, etc. Have you noticed any change in the behavior towards you of your former religious colleagues? This argument is widening.
I receive a spectrum of responses from my colleagues in the world of ministry and from people who engage with me from the world of faith, from faith communities. I have friends who've shared the journey with me, and even if they're not aligning with all my conclusions, understand how I'm getting there, understand the importance of what we're talking about, the importance to our self-understanding as a species, understanding of the cosmos, our understanding of God. And I'm so grateful for those friends because they are a small percentage. The majority of my colleagues in ministry are very, very quiet on this topic. They understand how I've got here because there is a central controversy in Christianity, which is to do with the relationship of our thoughts about God as Christians, and then all the information that's in the Hebrew scriptures, which I argue points to what we're talking about right now. It's a bit of a taboo. It's not really addressed in our training, and it's not addressed in church life. So there's this slightly embarrassed silence that probably takes in the majority of my colleagues, not wanting to be disrespectful. And then I have others for whom this is blasphemy. This is impossible. This is a contradiction of the fundamental idea of God as all-wise, almighty creator. And so I get a lot of anger projected on me and threats of eternal condemnation by the Almighty for raising these interesting topics. And I, to my surprise, I find when I get those kind of communications, some you just have to shrug them off and ignore them. But a lot of the time when I engage and I say, thank you so much for your message, the reason I think what I'm saying is this, this is the logic behind my view. 90% of the time, within a couple of exchanges, and this is, you know, in the Twitterverse, this is very terse communication, and yet within a couple of exchanges, we're actually on the same page, having a respectful conversation and acknowledging the things we don't know and the things that fascinate us. And I find that very encouraging because I do think that people are fundamentally curious creatures. I think that's the thing that raises us above our neighbors on planet Earth, the level of our curiosity. It is the engine behind all our technological advances. And I love sparking that. And people can give the impression that they don't have it when they come back very dogmatic. But it only takes a little bit of scratching beneath the surface to find, no, they're just as curious as I am, given the permission.
Yeah, the permission, right there. You've hit the nail on the head. It is fascinating that, you know, daily now we're seeing news reports of things that science says are impossible. You know, the discoveries of galaxies that shouldn't exist by all the known laws. I mean, you know, we've got so much evidence that we know nothing, nothing.
I quite agree. I think, is this a good moment to mention the blob?
Oh, yeah, I love the blob. I love the blob.
This is one of my favourite moments in Eric's book, where he describes this form of algae which demonstrates intelligence and behaviour that looks more like the behaviour of an animal than of a plant or what we would expect of algae. And it raises the question of where is the blob, because that's what it's called, where is the blob's intelligence? It doesn't have a brain, as we understand brains. It's even more intriguing than the octopus, which doesn't have a brain as we have brains. And you look at the behavior and you have to ask, where is the mind? Now, we're already asking that question for all sorts of good reasons. It is a question that interests me because of all the people I've met who've had out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences where they've been flat-lined on an operating table in an operating theater, and while they were dead, their consciousness was in the hallway listening to private conversations of doctors, nurses, and family members in a different part of the hospital. So when people have those experiences, it raises the question, what was hosting their consciousness at that point? They are seeing something, but not through their eyeballs. They're hearing something, but not through their ears. So what is supporting their consciousness in that moment? If you have pets, you're likely to be asking a similar question, because I have cats. Cats' brains don't have a language center. And yet we know that cats can respond to specific words. They don't have the same word power as a dog, but then we can't really explain the word power of dogs either. So if they don't have a language center like we have, what are they using to process and understand speech? Is it in the brain? Is it in the body? Or are they using their EMF, their electromagnetic field? We use it for other things. Yeah. We use it for what we call reflex actions. If we respond hyper quickly to something that could have hit us or injured us, the nervous system doesn't move that fast. We've got a perceptual field that's bigger than our bodies, and it's related to our EMF. Is that what the blob is using? Is it thinking with something outside its own body? And I would just encourage people, if you only read one bit of Eric's book, read the section of the blob, because it raises such profound questions about being.
Yeah. And, you know, we've already got a model for it, because, you know, where's the internet? Everything is stored in the cloud.
In the cloud, yes.
And we have to think about the mind is stored in the cloud as well. We're almost out of time. Very quickly, I want to ask you one last question. You asked Eric how he felt about serious academic supporters who were offering him material and support, but were anonymous about it. They wanted to keep their anonymity. What did he tell you?
I asked him if he found it annoying that there are all these eminent scientists in their fields who, behind closed doors, support Eric but won't say so publicly. And he said he's actually come to terms with that. He's very happy about it because he gets so much information from those sources, and he would cut himself off from the information if he said, well, I'm going to expose you for that. Mm-hmm. It is the role of the writer to push the boat out, to put out new ideas, and then academia can say, oh, let's discuss this crazy book this crazy guy has written. And that's how academic thought can move forward. But peer review is very conservatizing. It's very rare that it's from within the bowels of academia that the radical new idea comes. It's very often the outsider who puts it forward by saying, I've read your stuff. I'm joining the dots. The implications of what you said are these, aren't they? And to be willing to take the heat from the general public until the point where the academics come forward and say, well, Eric may have got it right here, or Paul may have got it right here. So it gives me courage to take a similar role and say, I'm willing to take that heat if it pushes the conversation further forward.
Which is what we've got to keep on doing. Paul, we're out of time now. Thank you so much for joining us today. And can you just tell people where they can find all of your videos and documentaries?
Go to fifthkind.tv and to the Paul Wallace channel on YouTube. And you can go to paulanthonywallace.com to keep up with my Eden books. Go to Amazon and you'll find Escaping from Eden, The Scars of Eden, Echoes of Eden, and next week, The Eden Conspiracy. And reach me through my website and we can get into a conversation.
Wonderful. And Evolution is Wrong, A Radical Approach to the Origin and Transformation of Life is a truly eye-opening book. It's published by New Page Books, and you can learn more about Eric von Daniken's work at daniken.com. That's it for this week. I'll see you again at the same time next week. Till then, goodbye from me, and thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Sandy. It's been a pleasure.